Zero to Book is brought to you by Rainmaker FM, the digital marketing and sales podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm.
A lot of people aspire to write a book. Maybe you do, but you probably know it's a complex process. Zero to Book is documenting the journey from start to finish so you can learn how to take your book from an idea to a published product. Listen in as best-selling author Jeff Goins helps Pamela Wilson go from zero to book.
Jeff, in the last episode, we were talking about research, which was super helpful. And we started to talk a little bit about audience, and I think I kind of cut you off.
You did. It was offensive.
I know. It's so rude, right? So, but I wanted to talk to you about audience on a separate episode because I feel like that's such a big topic. I know in the process of putting together my ideas for the book that I want to write, I've tried to always think about the audience. So I feel like I know the audience I'm going to be writing for pretty well because I've interacted with them a lot on Copyblogger, on my own website. I do a little bit of coaching, so I've interacted with them in those coaching sessions. But the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about is that I think when you're sharing your ideas about your book, you also need to take into account that the person you're sharing your idea with may not be in the audience that you're trying to reach with the book. And I feel like that should color how much you value the feedback that you get from them. Because honestly, if they are not in the audience that you're trying to reach, you know, is their feedback as valuable as someone who's in the audience that you're actually trying to target with the book?
So I have an interesting perspective on this. At least I think it's interesting. I think all feedback is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work for a nonprofit, and we had this practice that I came to realize it just kind of felt normal because we did it all the time on our staff, on our team. I thought it was normal in the workplace, and we would have this regular routine of asking each other for feedback, essentially asking a coworker for criticism, like, tell me what I could do better about this. And it was almost always done in a spirit of openness and willingness to receive. And so, you know, when I translated that experience to working in an office where there was like more hierarchy and egos and try to say, hey, got to give you some feedback on that. I got, not welcome responses.
I will let you know when I want your feedback. Thank you very much.
Yeah, right. Like I'm talking to my boss. Hey, can I give you some feedback on that? No, you can't. Yeah, but I just was like, oh, this is weird. This is not normal everywhere. And I've tried to take that same spirit to my platform as an author, blogger, speaker, et cetera. And it's been not the easiest thing because, you know, when you do stuff on the internet, some people don't like it apparently, no matter how hard you try. And I feel like I'm, you know, finally maturing to the point where I can sort of take it in stride. But the other week, I was looking for a reason to quit my job and become a janitor, which means I was reading my Amazon reviews. And I was like, I could not resist the temptation to click that little button that says read more critical reviews. You know, so if you go to your Amazon page and click reviews, they've got like positive reviews, which are 4- and 5-star reviews, and then critical reviews, which is 1 to 3 stars. And then if you click that, it'll basically be a series of repeated, you know, punches to the gut. And so I was like, I can't resist, and I pressed
it.
That's
a way to ruin your day with one click.
I know. I'm a masochist, but that's most writers. And so I was trying to feed my own self-loathing, apparently. And I started reading it, and I came across this 3-star review. Which, you know, doesn't sound terrible until you realize 3 out of 5 is 60%. So you're at like a D minus. And I read this laudatory, very positive, helpful 3-star review from somebody who had read my book. And she said lots of nice things. It was kind of written like a book report where she was just sort of stating the facts. And then she said, yeah, he lost me here. I didn't really dig that. I'd love a book about this. But all in all, you know, it was a good read and I'm glad I read it. And it wasn't like the over the top roll your eyes, like this person is the best author in the world, you know, where you don't really believe that anyway. And at the same time, it wasn't like the one star, this was a complete piece of trash and I actually got dumber reading it. And so it was believable, you know, it was like, I don't think all criticism needs to be taken to heart, but I was like, wow, buried in this, you know, treasure trove of gut punches was something helpful to me. And then I went through and read a bunch of kind of nasty, mean reviews and just silly things like, I didn't get the book. I hate this guy.
Yeah.
You know? But I was like, okay, whatever. I had this very weird moment where I reached a state of author nirvana and I, you know, raised out of my body and I looked down and I saw myself going, oh, that's okay. The book wasn't for them. And I think feedback can be useful. I just think we have to develop filters on what we do with that feedback. And so if somebody goes, this is complete trash, you didn't do this, this, or this, like, you know, I had somebody read my book and they said, you know, you didn't talk about art enough. And I was like, well, the book isn't about art, you know,
yeah.
It's called The Art of Work. And,
right.
And I don't understand that because you don't go to The Art of War and go, well, where are
it's
all the references
not about
to
art,
painting?
Right.
The art of. But I was like, that's okay. The book wasn't for them.
Right. So you're saying that all feedback is valuable, but it sounds like at the same time you are saying the book is not for them, which is basically what I'm saying too.
Yeah.
That not everyone is the audience that you're trying to reach. And I think in particular, when you're writing about a topic that's kind of a niche topic, that you don't expect it to appeal to a broad swath of humanity. You just really are targeting a very narrow slice of the pie. I think in that case, it's like even more. Do you have to kind of feel like, okay, this is going to appeal to a select group of people and then other people are just not going to be interested or they're not going to get it. It's not for them.
Yeah, I would say two things. One, all feedback is a gift, but not all feedback is relevant. And so if I go, you know, Pamela, I read this book and I thought it just told me a bunch of stuff about content marketing that I could have gone and read on CopyBlogger. And, you know, I didn't really get it. By the way, I also thought that your research process could have been a little bit better. A lot of secondary sources here. Where are your primary sources? Sincerely, Jeff. like, I think the healthy way to respond to that, I mean, the healthy way to respond to that is thank you, by the way.
Yes.
And then the way to internally respond to it is to go, well, the book wasn't really for him, you know? The book is for people that are doing this and are trying to make their way and they need this as a reference tool beside them. And so this just wasn't for him. But that's interesting what he said about research. I wonder if I could do better at that next time.
Right.
Or
right.
Maybe at some point I do want to write a book that's going to reach that kind of audience. And so I'm curious what they think about this, even if this book wasn't for them. So that was the first thing I would say is feedback can be a gift without it necessarily being relevant, meaning you've got to sort of blow the thing up and rebuild it because one person, you know, didn't like it. The second thing is most books in one form or another are niche books. They're not for everyone. And in fact, if you write something that's for everyone, that's the worst way to write something
right,
for everyone. The
best
way is to write something for a select group of people and then to give it legs where it could, you know, kind of go and live in other genres without it being a stretch. For example, content marketing could be something that aspiring authors read. It could be something that, you know, tried and true marketers and advertisers, you know, could read. It's something that CEOs could read who want to adopt more of a content marketing perspective. It could be something that small business owners, you know, would want to read. And so it has lots of legs in different niches. See, we're cross-cultural with this podcast.
You're right. Tomato, yeah. Tomato.
But
yes.
Yeah, I think you can still go, okay, that's interesting. That's helpful. You know, I can use that in future writing. In terms of all writing being niche marketing, I think of the book, The War of Art. So we've talked about the Art of Work, my book, The Art of War, Sun Tzu, and now the War of Art, by Stephen Pressfield, which really was a nonfiction book that this novelist, who was a niche writer, was writing war novels about ancient Sparta and whatnot. And he wrote this book because he had lots of friends asking him, how do you write? You know, how do you do this? And like any author, like anybody who has experienced any kind of success, you tend to attract the kind of people that want to repeat your success. So he wrote this book and it did not blow up. It was basically a short series of, we would call it, you know, a bunch of blog posts now, although this was in the 90s.
So and essays probably.
Yeah, there were these punchy little like one-page essays, yeah, articles, little just short little rants about how to overcome your creative blocks and, you know, do the work of writing. But he wrote it in an interesting way where there were these sort of legs to it. And what ended up happening is the book, you know, just kind of went on to become one of those sleeper bestsellers where never hit any big New York Times bestsellers list or anything. And just hundreds of thousands of people picked that book up and shared it. And when I would talk to my friends who are writers, and I go, how do I do what you do? They would say, read this book. They all said the same thing. Read this book. And so I read it and I was like, oh my gosh. And then people started coming to me. How do you become a writer? I was like, read this book. And so it had this really interesting, you know, life to you know, it, you know, sort of self-perpetuating form where it just kind of kept spreading by people who had read it, which is the mark of a truly great book. But it wasn't just writers who were reading it. It was actors and screenwriters, and it was authors and artists and entrepreneurs, because everybody, all of those people have creative blocks that they're trying to work through. And Steve wrote it as a writer. And was basically talking to other writers, but the language that he used was specific enough that people go, oh yeah, that's for me, but broad enough that different, you know, niches could access it. That's not every kind of book, but that gives you an idea of how when you write for a very, very specific audience, it can have a broad reach. Incidentally, that book, I think 15 years-ish after it was published, got into the hands of Oprah, and Oprah had Steve on her show, and she said, hey, I love this book. This is a great book. And the next week, this is got to be 15, 16 years into the life of the book. For the first time ever, it hit the New York Times list.
That is a great story. The Oprah effect. Yes.
Yeah, it still works.
That's amazing. All right. So I wanted to talk a little bit to our audience about what we are doing in the next couple of weeks, because we're kind of banking our episodes of this Zero to Book podcast because you have this major event happening in your life. So do you want to share that a little bit?
My wife and I are having our second child, our first daughter. And so life is about to get crazy again, at least for us. So yeah, that's happening soon. And I am trying to work pretty hard to be able to take a month off to spend time with her and the baby and make sure our son doesn't feel neglected. We're not quite sure how he's going to react to becoming a big brother. He seems excited. But yeah, big event for us. And, I want to be able to be present to my family.
Yeah, that's great. I'm so happy to hear that you're doing that. I am on the complete opposite end of the parenting continuum from where you are, because my youngest just turned 21. And I also had a boy and a girl, just like you. I had a boy first and then a girl. So the boy is 23. And I mean, I guess I'm probably not allowed to call him a boy anymore, but my son is 23. My daughter is 21. So I'm on the other end of that. And all of that time is time well spent. So I'm very happy to hear that you're doing that. And so what we're doing, basically, I mean, I knew about your schedule and I was looking at my own schedule for getting this book produced. And I knew that at some point I needed to stop talking about writing the book and actually start writing it. So the next couple of episodes are going to be me trying to get in my last questions before you kind of log off to be with your family, which is a wonderful thing. So that's why I'm kind of peppering you with all these questions about what about research? What about your audience? And, you know, I have a few more to go over in upcoming episodes, and then, you'll be able to have your time with your family without any interruption. So I wanted to let our listeners know what we're doing over here.
Cool.
Yeah. And at some point you know, like I said, I'll be focused on getting that book written. And I guess my last question for this episode is just, you know, what do you think is a realistic time period for getting the book written by someone who's basically doing it while she has a full-time job, a job that is actually more than full-time? But I'm going to be writing the book on my own time. So I'm going to be writing it on weekends, evenings, early mornings. So, and I don't know if there's even an answer to that question, but that was kind of the final thing I wanted to ask you for this episode was, what do you think is a realistic time period?
Well, okay, so two things. One, on the writing for an audience thing, I want to backtrack and give people an exercise. And this might even be able to help your writing, Pamela. You may already have, I know you have some sort of customer avatar, your ideal reader, for example, copyblogger.com. And I would encourage you to do the same thing for the reader of this book.
Yes.
Imagine, picture them, have a little post-it note, whatever. And what I am a big fan of when you're writing a book is to very clearly write out what the argument is. So I want to, for example, persuade, Susie or John, whoever your avatar is, that blank, you know, blah, 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 blah. And what follows is your argument that, all marketing is now content marketing, or I want to teach or empower my reader to blank, blank, blank. Really, that needs to be so focused that somebody could read your book and then, not 6 months from now, but tomorrow, get up and do bam, bam, bam. Right?
Yes.
So take the 4-hour work week, for example. I don't know that Tim Ferriss did this, but you could do this with this book. You could basically say the argument of the book is, I like to phrase it like this: every blank should blank. Every person working a day job can create more freedom in their lifestyle, no matter wherever they are, whatever they're doing. So your argument is every blank should blank. That would be a persuasive argument, or every blank can blank. So every blank is your target market. Could be every person, every content marketer can or should blank, and that's just, that's the
right
thing you're going to teach.
I can tell you what mine is. Mine is,
yeah.
Well, every non-writer, every person who does not consider themselves a writer, who is busy. I mean, this is way too long, Jeff, okay? But I'm trying to expand it so you understand what I'm going for. Yeah. So every person who's a non-writer who is busy running their business or working for the organization they work for and doing their jobs, so busy that they don't have a chance to, stay on top of how to create fantastic content, and they don't feel confident about it. So that's what I mean by non-writer. Every non-writer can learn to craft a piece of content that markets their business effectively. And it can be fun, and it can be relatively easy, and you can kind of go from idea to finished product pretty quickly when you have a system. So that's way too long, but that's kind of what I'm aiming for.
Yeah. So, basically what you want is you want your reader to be able to pick up your book, read it, and when they're done reading it the next day, they should be able to use some of the information. They don't have to have internalized and digested all of it, but they should be able to use some of the information by referencing the book or just remembering it and sit down and craft that piece of content.
Yes. That's right. The idea. Yes. Definitely.
So then the question is, well, how do you do that? And then the answer is chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3.
Right.
That really is. It's just different. Here's how to do it. And if you go back to the 4-hour work week concept, okay, how do you create more freedom? Well, first of all, you need to recognize that 80% of the work that you're doing doesn't matter. And so cut all of that out. And here's lots of stories about how people did that in their day job, yada, yada, yada. So the first thing you have to do is you kind of have to hack your productivity. The second thing you have to do is decide how much money you actually need to live. It may not be as much as you want. And, and on and on and on it goes. And they're just different chapters, really all based around that idea that when you're done with this book, you should be able to take some idea, some piece of it, and create more freedom in your lifestyle, no matter where you are, no matter whatever you're doing. So that's what you want. Okay, so that's, I think just kind of wrapping up the audience part of the conversation is important. So if you don't know what your argument is, you need to fill in those blanks. Every blank can or should blank. Mm-hmm. And then you need to answer the other question, which is when somebody's done with my book, what's the next, like tomorrow, what should they be able to do? It should be that, you know, that empowering objective statement. Okay, what was the next, what was the question that I didn't
answer?
Well,
what I wanted to know, and this may be, I used to tell my kids when they would ask me questions when they were growing up, I used to say, that is a UQ. That means mm-hmm. it's an unanswerable question. Mm-hmm. So I'm very sorry, but I don't have an answer to that because you know how they ask you questions about everything that are impossible to answer. So this may be a UQ, but I wonder what is a realistic amount of time?
Oh, yeah.
I want to get this done.
Yeah.
So
well,
go ahead and give me something kind of aggressive and I'll go for it.
It's not a UQ. I mean, it is math. And I am super practical about this part because people go, oh, I'm going to write a book. Well, how long is the book going to be? How many words are you going to write per day? How much time do you have to write, et cetera, et cetera. So this is how you do the calculation. It has nothing to do with how much time you have, how much you want to do it, what you want is, none of that matters with this. This is a math question and it's all about deadline. And so we have to begin with the deadline. I don't care if you're working for yourself and this is an arbitrary thing, you have to set the deadline. So when's the deadline?
Well, we have to work back. I want to have it launched in the fall.
Okay.
I'd like to have it launched by the beginning of October at the latest.
All right.
And then we have to work backward with the production time for the book and getting it on Amazon and all of those things. So I don't have a good concept of how much time those things take. I would say, I mean, just based on what I've read and what you and I have talked about, May, right?
So let's say October 1st is the pub date. Just kind of being a little bit arbitrary. And this is what publishers do too. They just give themselves lots of padding and basically set more or less arbitrary dates. So October 1 is the pub date. And then I think you're going to want at least a month to review it before it goes to print. So that's September 1, you know, kind of final page proofs in and all of that design stuff. Month before that, you can kind of do all of your interior cover design, that sort of thing. And so probably 2 months before that, you're going to do editing and formatting and that sort of thing. So that brings us back to June 1. And so, yeah, I like May 1 as a deadline.
Okay.
And so, we're sort of removing the mystery of when this thing is hitting, but it's January 18th right now that we're recording this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like, let's say you don't write in, let's just see here. I'm bad at math. Let's see how many weeks we have. So we've got 1, 2.
That's like 3 full months, 3.5 months. That feels like a lot of time to me. I mean, I've got a lot of other things I'm juggling with my job and in my life, but that feels like a lot of time. I feel like I'll be able to do it in that amount. What I typically do, just so you know, is you told me May 1st. In my mind, I already converted that to April 1st.
Yeah.
Because I'd rather push for that deadline and get it done early and have more time than have not enough time.
Right.
And I do that with everything. I actually teach that in our membership program, in our authority membership program. I teach people to set fake deadlines because they actually alleviate a lot of stress. If you set yourself a deadline that's well ahead of when it's actually due, you have plenty of time for the you-know-what to hit the fan and for everything to go wrong and for you to recover from that because you've set a fake deadline.
So I'm looking at, you know, if you just kind of shave some here and there, you're looking at about 16 weeks, which would be 4 full months.
Right.
You begin with, I've got 16 weeks to write. How many words is the book going to be approximately?
Yeah. And that's the other thing I don't know. For a nonfiction book, it's usually 50,000 as a minimum, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say 50,000 to 65,000 is going to get you that, you know, 160 to 250 page book.
Mm-hmm.
A 200 page book is going to be, I think, right around 55 to 60,000 words. Depending on size of font and all that stuff. So you've got 50,000 words. You've got 16 weeks. How many days per week are you going to write? Are you going to write 7 days, 5 days? What seems reasonable based on?
I mean, the realistic thing is that I'm going to write during chunks of days. Mm-hmm. So I'll have an hour in the morning here, an hour in the morning there. So maybe it's more realistic to tell you how many hours a week. Could okay. I give you that?
Sure.
I think consistently I could give it 10 full hours a week. And I write pretty fast.
Yeah. Okay. So 10 hours times 16 weeks. So you got 160 hours. And you've got, you know, 50,000 words. And you basically need to figure out how much time, like how much writing can I get done in an hour, for example?
Right.
So, you know, if you've got, let's say it's 500 words you can get done in an hour.
Yeah, no, I can get so much more done. I mean,
1,000? What do you think?
I mean, we're talking about first draft quality, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's closer to 1,500. I would say consistently, yes. The thing is, I write so much content right now, so this mm-hmm. is probably not everyone else's story, but I use a product called Grammarly. Are you familiar uh-huh. with that?
Sure, yeah.
So they send you this weekly review of how you've done, like how many grammar mistakes you've made compared to the rest of the Grammarly users. And I regularly get an email from them that says, you've written more than 99% of the Grammarly users. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like at this point in my life, that pump is just primed all the time because I'm writing all the time, which is one of the reasons I feel confident about it. I hope this doesn't bite me in the butt, but I feel confident about it right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say it does bite you in the butt. Let's say you write a third of the amount that you think you're going to because you don't take into thought, research and editing and your perfectionism takes over. Let's say you write 500 words an hour and you get to write your 10 hours a week, which is 160 hours in the next 16 weeks. That's 80,000 words.
Yeah, that's more than enough.
Yeah, so now you're 30,000 over your limit. Maybe you decide, this is really a 60,000 word book. I need to cut 20,000 words, turn that into bonus content, whatever. If you write your 1,500 words, you've got 240,000
words. Yeah, way too much. Okay.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, it just gives you an idea. Or what that really means is you're done in March.
Right.
And you can just spend the rest of the time editing. So, more broadly for, people listening, if you want to write a book, it's very simple. You need to set a deadline and you need to backtrack from there, just as Pamela's done. How much time do I have to write? And how many days do I have to write? And how much per hour or per writing session? I just think in terms of writing sessions.
Right.
And I am a slow writer. I play the long game. And instead of trying to be really aggressive and write 3,000 words one day and then let a whole week go by, I'm just trying to get as many at-bats as possible. And on average, I'm writing about 500 words a session. And if I can get another rep in the same day, great. If I have to do it tomorrow, fine. But if you want to know what that looks like, just do the math as we've done it. Decide how many days you have, what days you're going to write, or how many sessions you're going to have, and then just divide your word count by the amount of days that you have, and you realize, I only need to write 300 words a day if I do it consistently. You'll find that it's much less than you need it to be. And I recommend using Scrivener for this. It's a $45 piece of software. One of my favorite things about it, this I think pays for itself, is if you create a project in Scrivener, you can basically, it'll do the math for you. And you can say, my due date is May 1st, and these are the days that I'm going to write. These are the days that I'm not going to write. How many words per day do I need to write? And it'll calculate that for you. But let's say you miss a day or 5 days or go on vacation and you open up Scrivener the next day and it has to sort of recalculate everything. It'll do that immediately. It'll open it up and it'll say, now you need to write 700 words a day to stay on track with your
deadline. Interesting.
It's awesome.
Yeah. That's great.
You heard me stumbling over my calculator just now. I need that.
Yeah. No, that's great. It's great to know that it will recalculate based on the time that you've left yourself. Very smart.
It's like a GPS.
Yeah. Very cool. Recalculating your route.
Yes, that's right.
All right. Well, good. This is actually making me feel very encouraged because I think, and it's interesting, I think for anyone listening, you do have to know how you tend to write best. For example, the way that you're saying you write 500 words at a time, that wouldn't work for me. I need to just sit down, turn on the spigot, and let it pour out all at once. You know, like I can't do 20 minutes here or even an hour here and then an hour later in the day. It tends to work better for me earlier in the day. And I can get all those words out in a short amount of time, but they kind of need to happen in one session for me. Yeah. So I think knowing your pattern and what seems to work best for you is probably a really important part of this equation.
Yep, that's true. There's basically, most people believe there's two different types of writers. There are bingers and plotters. A binger is somebody who will literally write a book in like a weekend or like 2 weeks. And then there are plotters who will just show up every day. I'm a plotter. I just show up and go, okay, 500 words, 500 words. And when I'm done, I go, oh yeah, like this is a thing. And really blogging probably taught me that. Just show up every day and write a little bit. And if you do that for, you know, 3 months, 6 months, a year, you're going to have, quite a body of work to show.
So I have to tell you, just to give you some different labels that might make you feel better about it, I've heard it referred to as a marathoner and a sprinter.
Yeah.
So you are a marathoner for sure. You're just in there for the long haul. You're going at it, putting in the miles. And I'm probably more of a sprinter. I'm like, yeah, let's just get this done. Sit down there and pour it out. So, and I think knowing that about yourself, there's not one way that works better than the other. It's just knowing yourself so that you know what's going to work best for you.
Yep, absolutely.
Very cool. All right, so I have more questions to ask you, but I think I'll save them for future episodes. And as usual, thank you so much for your help, Jeff.
Thank you. It was fun.